This is day three of this December 2013 four-day session. We'll return to our text from earlier, the book called Zen Essence. It's an anthology of teachings, short teachings of various great Chinese masters, and it's translated and edited by Thomas Cleary. We left off yesterday with a master, Fen Yang, from the 10th to 11th century. When you suddenly realize the source of mind, you open a box of jewels. Honorable on earth and in the heavens, you are aloof even from the joy of meditation. The essence, containing all flavors, is the supreme delicacy, worth more than 10,000 ounces of pure gold. The only thing I would comment on here is this statement, you are aloof even from the joy of meditation. This is describing a sublime state of detachment. Most people would like nothing more than to experience joy all the time. There is a kind of joy, though, a quiet, deeply grounded, centered joy that is very different from kind of emotional state that ordinary joy is. Ordinary joy is always transitory. It's always bound to pass. But the joy, the aloofness, I don't know, this word can be misleading. Sounds often the word aloof is joined with cold, and it's not at all what he means here. Next one. When you are deluded and full of doubt, even 1,000 books of sutras are still not enough. When you have realized understanding, even one word is already too much. When you're settled in Zen, your mind is serene, unaffected by worldly distractions. You enter the realm of enlightenment and transcend the ordinary world, leaving the world while in the midst of society. This echoes what I think from another tradition they say, to be in the world but not of the world. To be in the world. Where else could we be but in the world? This is the world too. But not of it is same quality that we were just saying about this detachment. This detachment doesn't mean disengagement. It means a freedom from being pitched around by changing conditions and circumstances. You enter the realm of enlightenment. Well, even if not having experienced actual awakening, this could mean here entering the realm that is beyond this and that, beyond. Transcending the ordinary world, which means as he says, leaving the world while in the midst of society. After a sesshin, especially a 7-day sesshin, but perhaps a shorter one too, after a sesshin, we can get just an inkling of what this means when we go back out into the world, back to our families, to the malls, back to work. We enter those situations different, at least for a while. The mind is so collected, so grounded. The next master is Shwedo. His Japanese name is Secho. Anyone familiar with the Blue Cliff record knows the name Secho. He offered his comments in many of the koans in the Blue Cliff record. It's easy to get him mixed up with Yuan Wu. Yuan Wu is considered the author of the Blue Cliff record, even though it's just a collection of dialogues and stories. So strictly speaking, you could question whether he could be called the author, maybe the editor. But Shwedo also offers his comments scattered out through the Blue Cliff record. So someone asks Shwedo, what is the living meaning of Zen? Shwedo said, the mountains are high, the oceans are wide. Just that. Zen Master Dogen, who was Japanese, went to China and spent 9 years of monastic training in China, and when he came back, having come to awakening, someone asked him, what did you realize in China? And he said that my eyes are horizontal and my nose is vertical. The simplest fact of things. Things are what they are. This understanding, this kind of statement has infiltrated contemporary culture. You hear people here and there saying, it is what it is. I know someone who's not a member of the Sangha who once said, there are these three catch-all phrases that you can use to wrap up any conversation, any discussion or argument. One is, it is what it is. Another is, it's all good. And the third is, whatever. You hear these phrases tossed around. Well, the first two actually, if there were any understanding behind those first two, this is profound significance. Everything is what it is. There. And the great Chinese master Yunmen said, every day is a good day. But to really have plumbed these two statements is another matter. It takes years, if not decades, of practice to really grasp the essential point of them. When you illuminate your perception, your eyes are like 1,000 suns, so that nothing can escape notice. Ordinarily, people just have never been so observant, but they should not give up in frustration because of underestimating themselves. When you illuminate your perception, it's a very conceptual way of saying when you come to true enlightenment, your eyes are like 1,000 suns, so that nothing can escape notice. This is one of the byproducts of deep, mature practice is noticing things, noticing people and what's going on with them. It's also called awareness. Of course, it would be a byproduct of long meditation. Developing awareness. Ordinarily, people have never been so observant. His translations can be a little odd sounding. People just have never been so observant, but they should not give up in frustration because of underestimating themselves. Well, this is just solid advice that can apply to anyone on the path, any spiritual path. Don't give up in frustration because you lose faith in yourself. That's what underestimating themselves means. The wise boldly pick up a truth as soon as they hear it. Don't wait for a moment or you'll lose your head. Everything is a matter of the ripeness of the mind, the readiness of the mind to see things as they are. This ability to see things as they are is, of course, a capacity available to all of us. And when we do grasp the truth as soon as we hear it, it's because it's an echo of what we already know, an echo of our inherent wisdom, what we've always known. It's just a matter of bringing the mind to the kind of stillness that we can receive and recognize what we've always known at some level of the mind. Someone asked Shui Do, "What is your manner of teaching?" Shui Do replied, "When guests come, one should receive them." Actually, the translation is, when guests come, one should see them. I thought that see meant receive, but another way to take it is guests, understanding guests as makyo and other transitory states of mind. This is really an essential, extremely vital part of Zen practice, is recognizing a state of mind when it is inhabiting the mind temporarily, because it's always temporary, to see it as a mind state that will pass. In a way, that's what everything practice is. Thoughts, makyo, emotional states, to not get caught in them, to see them as just passing clouds passing through the mind. If we could do that at every moment, then everything would just unfold, our practice would unfold and move along beautifully. But the problem is people get snared in different states of mind, and only after a few minutes maybe, or a few hours, or even a few days, do we suddenly realize that it's just been this mind state that we were caught in. It can be any kind of thing, fear, anxiety, euphoria, discouragement. Discouragement's a state of mind. It's just a passing cloud. Doubt is what we could call a guest. It's not the host. What is the host? What is Mu? What is it? What is it that sees these guests? What is it that knows? Who am I? Once there was a Zen elder. Elder probably means teacher. Once there was a Zen elder who didn't talk to his group at all during a retreat. One of the group said, "This way, I've wasted the whole retreat. I don't expect the teacher to explain Buddhism, but it would be nice at least to hear the two words, absolute truth." The elder heard of this and said, "Don't be so quick to complain. There's not even a single word to say about absolute truth." Then when he had said this, he gnashed his teeth and said, "It was pointless to say even that." In the next room was another elder who overheard this and said, "A fine pot of soup befouled by two rat droppings." And then Shuedo says, "Whose pot hasn't one or two droppings in it?" This is the dilemma, kind of koan for anyone talking about Zen, is that knowing that it's not in the words. So what you do is make sure that the words come out of the guts, that the words are informed with understanding. And then it is in the words. Not apart from the words. The next master is Zen Master Huang Long. who was born in 1002 and died just 67 years later. Just a little statement here in the afterword about him. Zen seekers should sit on the site of universal enlightenment right in the midst of all the thorny situations in life and recognize their original face while mixing with the ordinary world. Again, this emphasis that you find all through Zen texts of bringing the practice into one's busy life, proving it in the world of activity. Here's the first of the selected passages here by Wang Long. Seekers should open their own eyes. Don't let yourselves in for regret later on. Zen cannot be reached by psychic powers or by cultivation of special experiences. Zen cannot be discussed by means of the knowledge or intelligence of the merely learned. Don't let yourselves in for regret later on. Oof. Very powerful warning. And then just one other from Huang Long. All sages since remote antiquity have entered the pit of life and death, gone into the fire of ignorance to help people out. What about you? How do you enter? If people can enter, this can be called not burning in fire, not drowning in water. If people cannot enter, they not only cannot help themselves, they cannot help others. So this is some good stuff in here. All the enlightened ones have entered the pit of life and death. The pit of life and death. Have faced this world of changing phenomena and seen through it. Has seen into the illusory nature of the self. The illusory nature of phenomena, in fact. Gone into the fire of ignorance. You could understand this as such ones have seen deeply into their delusions. And when we truly see into our delusions, we see that there's nothing there. They have no substance to them. We see that, in fact, that these very delusions are not other than our true nature. But this can mean a lot of pain on the way to seeing through them. I can't help when I see the word fire in during Sesshin, I can't help but thinking of pain, the physical pain that people can get into in Sesshin, and the importance of just entering that fire of pain as the only true way to transcend it, not to avoid it, not to make up thoughts and mental games as a way of getting away from it, not fighting it, but just stepping right into the fire. How do you do that? How do you enter the fire of pain? Through the practice, through the breath, through the koan. The whole trick with pain is to become one with it, as most of you know. And to become one with pain, you become one with the practice that you're working on. It's the same thing. The practice, that the breath or the koan or whatever it is, the practice is a way of becoming completely entering direct experience, detaching from thoughts and becoming one with what is now, direct experience. And at times that may mean pain. But what we find is that is really the best, by far, the best way of learning to manage pain in Sesshin is just giving ourselves up completely to the practice that we're working on. And the physical pain really is the least of it. It's all of the painful things that we have to face when we have nowhere to go, nowhere to run. We're left literally up against the wall of ourselves, ourselves facing ourselves nakedly, courageously, facing our defilements, the fears and anxieties, the pettiness, the many unsavory things about our personality and character. It's all going to be exposed sooner or later. This is how we become whole. Whole people. This is how we integrate every aspect of ourselves. It takes great courage to get through Sesshin. It really does. No one should ever underestimate that. Very few people, I would wager, very few people have the courage and the faith to sit day after day with nothing to grab onto, nothing to distract themselves with. Well, we can always find something to distract ourselves with. Nothing on the outside. In this just directly looking into the mind, this is the pit of life and death. And then he says, if people can enter, this can be called not burning in fire, not drowning in water. Because when we discover this true self that is no self, then there's no one left to burn in the fire. There's no one left to drown in the water. There's no one there. We see the illusory nature of the ego. Zen Master Mumon said, if you wish to know real gold, see it in the midst of fire. There's so few ways in contemporary life where we really have to sit through this fire, where we're really tested in the way that we are in Sesshin. And out of this testing comes tremendous strength, centeredness, and faith. It takes faith to get through the fire, and it builds faith. The fire is like a smelting furnace, forging this great strength in us. The more sesshins you go to, the more this strength builds like a diamond. The next master is Zen Master Yang Chi. And here too, there's nothing that is suitable to read from him, very little at all. It's just mostly the translator's highly intellectualized comments. So he said, someone asked Yang Chi, "It is said, if you want to escape from clamor in the mind, you should read the ancient teaching." That's the end of the quote. And then the questioner says, "What is the ancient teaching?" Yang Chi replied, "The moon is bright in space. The waves are calm on the ocean." The waves are calm on the ocean. Another master said, "Even strong winds are powerless to disturb the water of a deep well." Another time, Yang Chi said, "Mind is the faculty, phenomena are the data. Both are like scratches in a mirror." Let's just comment on this. So we can always, in words, we can always divide this indivisible reality into subject and object, mind and phenomena, or mind and things, as we say in Affirming Faith of Mind. Things are things because of mind, as mind is mind because of things. This is ultimately an arbitrary way, an arbitrary division of things as they are. But we can talk about subject and object, mind and phenomena. And Yang Chi here says, both are like scratches in a mirror. The mirror is a favorite simile in Zen for the mind, our true mind. These are words or concepts that stain or scratch this mirror. And then he says, when there are no scratches or dust, the clarity of the mirror shows. This is beyond subject and object, beyond such divisions. This is a mind undivided, this mirror. And then he finally says, when mind and phenomena are both forgotten, then your nature is real. The next little one is about Bodhidharma. Someone asked Yang Chi, when the founder of Zen came from India to China, he sat facing a wall for 9 years. What does this mean? Yang Chi said, as an Indian, he couldn't speak Chinese. It's one of the things we mostly miss from these old texts is the humor that undoubtedly these masters showed all the time. We get little snatches of it like this. There's probably so much more that we'll never know. The next master is his name is Chinese name is Wu Zhu. His whole name is Wu Zhu Faiyan, and his Japanese name is Goso. And looking at the afterword here, it says, Wu Zhu had already reached middle age when he entered Zen training under one of the Zen prodigies of the time, Bai Yun, a direct heir of Yang Qi, who became a Zen teacher at an unusually young age and passed away early. Bai Yun sent Wu Zhu to run the mill operated by the Zen monastery in a town below the mountain on which the monastery was located. It is said that whenever monks would come down the mountain snooping around, Wu Zhu would scandalize them by flirting with the young women who came to the mill. Wu Zhu was later known for a skill in teaching that was unique in his time, using graphic stories, colorful metaphors, earthy poetry, profound abstractions, paradoxical actions, and forthright statements to open the minds of his hearers. So he sounds like kind of a bad boy, this Wu Zhu. Flirting is one thing, very, very different from what keeps happening in Zen these days. When there is not a speck of cloud dotting the great clarity for 10,000 miles, sun and moon in the original sky are of themselves clear. It is not permitted for a general to see great peace, but a general may establish great peace. This is a wonderful metaphor. The way I take this is Kensho does not bring automatically, immediately bring complete peace of mind, but it establishes the basis for doesn't transform us immediately, but it establishes the basis for transforming us. There's still, after Kensho, after a first awakening, there's still an awful lot of cleaning up to do, a lot of residual and defilements, habit forces that keep swatting us in the face. But it does reveal that there's nothing to these habit forces. This is enormously, enormously important to see that they have no substance to them. And once we've seen this, experienced it, confirmed it, then they don't trouble us in the same way that they do before Kensho. To study Zen, first you must obtain directions to the ultimate goal. Hearing sound and seeing form are inconceivable, meaning they're not about conceptualizing, they're just the direct experience. From the eternal sky, every night the moon shines on every home. Its reflection descends into a quiet pool, but how many know? From the eternal sky, every night the moon shines on every home. Every home. No exceptions. Every single one of us is endowed with this luminous nature. And then a short one. Talking about Zen all the time is like looking for fish tracks in a dry riverbed. This is undoubtedly someone who was talking about Zen all the time. Again, there's always this sense of lament in a way. We teachers need to talk about Zen, need to present it in words so that others can be pointed in the right direction, but it's always, in a sense, it's always ultimately futile. That's the end of that master Wu Zhu's section, and rather than starting another one, we'll stop now and recite the four vows.